Welcome to Dentology, the Business of Dentistry podcast. In this podcast, we delve into the non-clinical aspects of dentistry with inspirational guests from across the profession. You will hear incredible life stories, pick up valuable business tips, and be entertained. I'm Andy Acton, and I'm joined by my co-host, Chris Jevons. So welcome to Dentology, the Business of Dentistry podcast. If this is your first time, you are very welcome. We're very pleased to be in your ears. And if you've been here before, if you've been here before, you know how it runs. If you could subscribe, that would be brilliant. It just helps us get up the rankings and you'll get to know about new episodes that come out every Monday at 7 o'clock. What a fascinating conversation with Suggs.
Oh, I tell you what, brilliant. Not Suggs of Madness, in case anyone got excited. but yeah, he's fascinating. I love the fact, yet again, this unassuming chap really was an entrepreneur from the age of 12.
Yes. You'll find out what he did there. But it also, I find it intriguing how many creative people there are. We've had people on who are musicians, poets, rappers, you know, break dancers, and now we've got, you know, Suggs does copywriting, and there's a link in there of some sort.
Yeah.
That creative people are drawn into dentistry, which is, it's slightly confusing because dentistry is very maths, science. It's quite
and
binary.
And seems quite straight, isn't it? Straight-laced sort of stuff.
And perhaps you need that kind of creative bit to balance yourself out.
You almost feel like there could be like a survey or something of, you know, of the 42,000 dentists, you know, how many of you have you passed your art over there? Yeah. Do you know what I mean? But it is fascinating, isn't it?
It is. And a nice guy, doing great
brilliant
work as well.
Lovely chap.
Absolutely fabulous episode. It's a good day when it's a podcast day, isn't it?
It's a great day. I love a podcast day.
Yeah.
It's intense, as in conversations, but it is really, really good fun because we learn so much about the people we talk to.
Yeah, I think it's that sort of curiosity thing, isn't it? I think chatting to people is...
Pretty nosy, just, other people.
It is, isn't it? It's fantastic. And today we're very fortunate. So today we have Saganthan Mahalingam joining us, otherwise known as Suggs.
Suggs.
And Suggs is a dentist and also a copywriter, which is quite an interesting twist.
Combo. Bit of a combo.
It is, isn't it?
I've ever met that combo.
It just surprises me, and we'll explore this as we go, that there are so many dentists with creative bents to what they do. And I don't think that's a coincidence. Anyway, welcome, Suggs. How are you?
Yeah, not too bad. It's good to be on there.
Yeah, no, looking forward to having the conversation today.
Yeah, brilliant.
And, I mean, there's definitely two sides to your world with the dentistry and the copywriting, which is a fascinating combination, and like I say, we'd explore that kind of creativeness. But before we get to that, can you kind of give us a sense of who you are with a little bit of background? Can you look back on your childhood and kind of tell us what that looked like, and they might give us clues as to the person that you've become today?
This is where we lean in, isn't
yes,
it?
Exactly.
Over to you, Sox.
I wouldn't say I had like anything particularly remarkable in terms of academics. So I think growing up, I was kind of somewhat average, went to a grammar school. I think kind of a typical dentist's kind of upbringing with regards to academics. I wasn't like a straight A student or anything like that. I took a lot of graft, a lot of failing, a lot of resits.
A lot of failing and a lot of resits.
Yeah. but I got there eventually. But I think in terms of the extracurricular side of things, I've always been involved with creative kind of pursuits. So when I first started, I was a graphic designer when I was about 12, 13.
Wow.
Then I started doing, web design. I'd made music for about 10, 15 years.
Write your own stuff and things like that?
Yeah. So I wrote my own stuff. I performed. I produced music. I engineered. I did quite a lot of stuff.
From what age was this, Suggs? What age were you saying? What, from 12 you sort of started all this, or were you doing?
When I was 12, I started the graphic design stuff.
Right.
And that was kind of like a little, so I never had a side job like a lot of people did when they were teenagers. I did that on the internet. So I was kind of making, you know, little bits of money just doing freelance design for people. And then
did
these people know that it was a 12-year-old boy who was doing their design for them?
No, they didn't. I had to just often lie. So I mean, I shouldn't say this on air, but like PayPal, you're not allowed to have a PayPal account unless you're 18.
Right. Use your dad's ID or something.
No, actually at the time they were a lot less strict. So I just didn't have any, you didn't have to have ID.
Wow, you just set it up.
You just set it up.
Bloody hell, entrepreneur at 12, flipping egg.
Yeah. Downside of that approach is they ask you eventually to verify your ID. And if you use a fake name, then all of a sudden you're screwed.
So, then you're in trouble.
Yeah.
So when was the music then? Was that sort of after that or?
So the music came in probably about 14. I just had an interest in it, and my friends were all into it, and we just kind of were doing music for a while. I was recording videos and stuff like that. And then once I got to uni, started performing live.
What type of music, Suggs?
Yeah, so it was hip hop. It was like a lot of hip hop music. I had a few people that I used to kind of make music with, and it kind of tapered off as I started to work as a dentist, but that's another story.
So you've also got this hugely creative side to you doing design and, you know, music, performing, that side of things. Whilst there is a very kind of aesthetic, creative end of dentistry, it tends not to be there from the very beginning when you're at dental school. We hear from lots of some Asian dentists that perhaps their parents say to them, you've got three choices. You can be an accountant, a lawyer, or four choices, an accountant, a lawyer, a dentist, or a failure. Was that similar to your kind of direction of travel?
Yeah, pretty much. I mean, if you'd asked me at 15, what did I want to become? I would have said a musician. That. But I mean, I don't regret it, because I think ultimately it's like a super unpredictable journey to follow, and it's really I know I've got friends who are musicians, and it's like it's hard. Really, really difficult what they have to go through. I don't regret it,
but I think part of the problem is that modern culture only shows us the phenomenal success stories of, you know, Justin Bieber, Taylor Swift, and all the other people that are right at the top of the tree. You don't see the legion of, you know, thousands who are struggling just to get by.
Wasn't it something, I remember Spotify, wasn't it something like there's 60,000 tracks uploaded every day or something? I mean, you've got to be able to be identified as something out of that volume. Is like, a lot of it's luck, isn't it? I think a lot of it's chance. Right?
Suggs, do you think if you'd have pursued it, because quite often they say that, you know, you love your hobby, but then you have a job. And if you'd have gone down that path and it would become your career, was there the potential that perhaps you wouldn't have been in love with it to the extent that perhaps you are, because it would have been so important to you in terms of your livelihood?
Yeah, I definitely agree with that. I think when you are focused on something that you love to put money on the table, it starts to become, you know, you're no longer... So the thing I like about these creative pursuits is just there's no rules. You know, I just, whatever's in my head, I can put it out there, and I don't have to care what other people think. Whereas when you're trying to put money on the table, you're all of a sudden you're trying to accommodate to a market, and you're trying to, you know, you're no longer making what you want to make. You're making what other people want you to make. And that's quite a difficult thing to navigate.
Just winding back a bit. Was there an awkward conversation with mum and dad about, hey, I want to pursue my music career, and they were like, "Yeah, that's great, but actually get a proper job." Was there anything like that, or was it sort of?
Do you know what? My parents were always super supportive about it. I mean, don't get me wrong, they didn't want me to pursue it as a full time thing. They were always very much like, you know, have your grades there and keep the academic side up, but whatever you want to do in your spare time, they didn't care about it. And they were supportive of it. In fact, and my dad still says to this day, like, why don't you still make music? And
interesting. I don't know. No medics in the family or anything like that, or were there?
I know my sister is a doctor. Yeah. So and most of my family, I mean, not my parents, but, you know, uncles and cousins and things like that, they're all medics.
Yeah.
Right.
So
do you know one of the things I love that you mentioned right at the beginning, which I think is a really important thing, and it's come out in a few, is the fact of you weren't super academic and you failed and had to resit. And I think that's a real character building. I know it sounds a bit naff, but it sort of is, isn't it? Because you've failed on something. You've got to try and do it again. It's brilliant. Yeah. That's brilliant.
Yeah, you're right there, because I felt like when I got to uni, because I've had so many kind of having to resit and redo papers and things like that, going to uni and failing, you know, the odd Viva or practical exam or whatever it was, it didn't hit me as hard as other people in my year who literally have never failed in their life, and it hit them really hard. And I felt really bad for them because I was like, mate, you just knuckle down, you'll get through it. Like, it's not that big a deal.
It's a great one though to be, I'm sorry, I was saying, it's a great one though to be at 18 and 19 to sort of almost have that resilience already developing within you where you can affect mentally your mates who are saying, look, you know, it's cool, don't worry about it.
Yeah.
You said when you were at school, you much preferred words than sort of numbers and science. So was that quite a shift for you to move from something where you could display your creative flair through words to numbers and science, which is pretty rigid? It's quite binary. It's kind of this or that. Was it for you academically, was that quite a hard shift?
Yeah, that was the biggest struggle, and I'd argue that's why I found it so difficult. So I think up until my GCSEs, it was all fine. It was kind of plain sailing. I was okay. When you had to go down to A levels and you have to choose maths and science, those were by far like not my strengths. You know, yeah. Bottom set. Maths, you know, I wasn't great at maths. Actually, the stuff I was good at, I didn't do for A level. And the reason for that was because it wasn't conducive to doing something like dentistry. You can't study French and you know, be a dentist.
Art.
Yeah, exactly.
Art and drama. So, what do you mean?
yeah. So it wasn't conducive to that. So I think I found it really difficult. That was a big challenge, like a big mindset shift, because I am not, well, now I've become like adaptable and able to kind of adopt that kind of mindset that's needed for dentistry. But initially it was really difficult.
Mm. But whilst you're portraying an individual who isn't naturally gifted academically, you obviously have the tools to get through, don't you? Because you say, you know, you failed, lots of research, you kind of failed a module, you redid it, you got it. Yet you have to have a degree of brightness to get yourself through dental school. So once you really knuckled down and you got into dental school, did you find it comfortable? Were you constantly feeling you were at your absolute limit, or did you find yourself in a lane where you started to understand what it required to get through dental school?
I'd say in the first 2 years, I found it really, really challenging. Mainly because, and I think a lot of dentists can empathize with this, you go from being spoon-fed and told what to do and what to learn and what to revise to, here's the resources, do what you will with it, and you just have to sit this exam. And I found that really difficult, especially the workload that was required. It was really challenging. And I think the moment it connected for me was when we started seeing patients. That was the moment that I was like, okay. Here's something that can actually engage me, rather than, even to this day, I don't really like reading papers and textbooks and stuff, you know.
It sort of fits in quite nicely. We do some courses sometimes, and we say you can have the education, and I won't mention anyone here, but, you know, there's lots of professors that we all meet who are the best at what they do, but you would not want to drink in the bar with them. But there's lots of very successful dentists who we can't make any judgment over the clinical, but they're probably not at the same level of as a professor. But boy, are they successful, and boy, are they entertaining and good fun, because they get on well with people. I think it sort of fits into that. You've obviously, your empathy is with people.
Yes. Yes. So you currently work in a mixed practice in Hertfordshire as an associate working in that practice. Is dentistry without access to the creative side enough for you, or do you need that kind of creative vent with the other sides of your life to make each side worthwhile?
Yeah, I've always known, even since I started dental school, I always knew I wasn't going to work full time. It wasn't something that I wanted to do. Even to this day, when I have had to work 5-6 days a week, it really drains me, because it's that, you know, that very logical, like you said, that very binary mindset. I mean, dentistry, don't get me wrong, it is creative in some regards, but a lot of it is rules and regulations and formulas and things you have to follow to get a certain result. Whereas I feel like with my creative pursuits, like copywriting and the other stuff I've done in the past, there aren't as many rules. It's you do what it needs to be done to get the job done, you know. And I think that's what appeals to me more. So that's why I need that
freedom,
outlet,
isn't it? Freedom of thought.
That's it.
Yeah. So how many clinical days a week do you do?
So I do 4 days a week at the moment.
Oh, so still quite a lot.
Yeah, still quite a lot.
One Saturday a month. It is still quite a lot, to be fair. But I'm making it work so far, and you know, I don't have any kids or anything like that, so it makes it easier.
Yeah,
I suppose it's quite good as well, because I imagine you know 4 days and a Saturday every other, you can generate decent revenue, which then enables you to hopefully have that time for your freedom and creative spirit to be released.
Mm. I think that's one thing that dentistry is amazing for, isn't it? That it does enable people to work kind of, you know, 6 days, 5 days, 4 days, 3 days, 2 days. Yeah. I don't think many do one day. I think one day is quite hard, just in terms of the practice you need to kind of stay fresh. But lots of people are around a kind of 3 day mark at the moment, and we've actually done a survey, and the results are coming out very soon around, you know, the amount of time that people want to work and do work, and it's certainly fallen back from the traditional 5 days, and many now don't do four, they do 3 days, which brings challenges, separate challenges for the profession in terms of access to dentists you know, the dental staffing, days available. So just on the writing side of things, you know, for lots of us, writing normally sits in a fairly narrow channel of just a communication with a client, a communication with a friend. It's a WhatsApp, it's an email, something like that. Well, what sort of writing interests you, and what's the thing that you take from writing from a sort of creative standpoint?
So the writing that I do predominantly now is copywriting. So what a lot of people don't understand, it's nothing to do with kind of legal terminology. That's what I thought when I first heard about it. I thought it was some sort of legal thing.
Yeah.
It's nothing to do with that. I think the easiest way to explain it to people is it's kind of salesmanship in the written word. So it's just, how do you sell something? Why? By writing. So in traditionally it was print. So you had magazines and you had letters that went out to people and things like that. Whereas now a lot of it is websites and landing pages and Facebook ads, things like that. So that's a lot of what I do now, and a lot of what kind of takes my interest is that.
Who do you do it for, Suggs? Who's your clients and such?
A lot of them are healthcare businesses,
right?
So not just necessarily dental. There are a few dental companies I work with, but there's just healthcare software companies, things like that. That's what I do a lot of the work with now, whereas initially when I started out, I worked with everyone. I worked with plumbers, I worked with, you know, electricians.
How did you get your clients? How did you sort of just like ping up an advert or something? How did that sort of work?
So starting out, there's a site called Upwork. I don't know if you guys are familiar with it.
Yeah.
So I started out on there, and a lot of the work on there is kind of very cheap labor. So you tend to get a lot of kind of people from, you know, lesser developed countries that come on there because it's easy for them to get work, but the amount they pay is not really not amazing. So a lot of people go on there for cheap labor. But for me, it was great because I just got to, you know, practice my skills on kind of low leverage work, really.
Mm.
It's quite a good idea, actually. You can almost get to fine tune some of your skills when you're then doing more expensive bits of work with maybe more demanding people, then it's great. Mm. It's quite smart, actually.
But particularly,
and you didn't have to pretend to be 18.
No. but particularly because you've got kind of your dental work that's kind of providing an income, you know, you can invest in developing the skill, understanding the market, you know, finding clients, building clients. This year, I think probably more than any, AI seems to be on the ship with everything you've got.
Wasn't it the word of the year in the Oxford Dictionary?
I can't remember. Well, you've got OpenAI.
And
RIS
was another word that I had no idea what that was, but now I know what RIS means.
You've got OpenAI in there, ChatGPT and Google Bard and a bunch of others. Can you see a time where it's going to, you know, AI will negate the need for copywriters, or are they never going to get good enough to be better than a human in terms of, you know, psychologically what it is we want to see and or what works for us?
I think it's an interesting one, really, because I think with AI, what people don't understand is it gathers information and it learns information at a really fast rate. So everything it comes up with, it's not creative. It doesn't create things from a variety of, it doesn't do what humans do. For example, we have a variety of experiences, we draw from them, and then we articulate that through writing.
Mm.
Whereas AI will study thousands, millions, God knows how many data sets, and compute what it thinks would be good copywriting. So I think the reason why I don't believe it's going to completely take over copywriting and kind of creative pursuits is because it doesn't understand emotion. And I think we're a long, long way off. I don't think in our lifetimes anyway, and I might be, I'm not a tech guy, so I don't know, I might be completely off here, but I don't believe it can process human emotion. So it's very difficult. So with copywriting, for instance, and sales, just generally, let's ignore copywriting, sales, everything is about emotion. It's not really about logic, which is what AI is very good at. It's logical things. Emotional things, it's not so great. It you know?
Yeah, that's true, isn't it, actually? And also, I think, I can remember there was something, I think on the BBC, you know, when AI was sort of like everywhere, and they did this thing where they said, can you tell the difference between something that had been written by a person and something that had been written by AI? And it was quite interesting because a lot of people were able to identify the AI bit because of the, I think maybe like the phrasing and stuff like you were saying, is it wasn't, it's not how we would do something. It was logical, but not emotional.
And I think quite often you do read things and it just doesn't land, and you can't quite pinpoint why, but there's just that quarter of a percent in you that you read it and it just feels mechanical. And it almost feels a bit perhaps corporate, right? It was written in a very safe, almost perfect way. But some of the things that we remember the most, like some of the best adverts we see are quite edgy. You know, some of the best catchphrases or strap lines you see are a bit edgy. And you're right, that probably comes from a human with a very particular thought process that goes behind that.
That's the thing. And I think also with AI, you have to be able to prompt it. So you have to be able to direct the AI to do what you want it to do. It's not enough just to be able to tell AI, for instance, write me a Facebook ad for my company.
Because come up with an idea.
Exactly. It will come up with really generic things. So you do need someone with the expertise and someone who understands psychology and things like that to prompt it to do the work. So I use it myself. You know, I use it for idea creation and kind of content ideation, but I don't use it to write my copy because when I've tried it, it comes off very rigid and wooden.
Oh, right. So for almost like a pre-positioning to give you some structural ideas, it's good. But when it actually comes down to the words. And
that's interesting.
In terms of what you create, how do you get into that kind of state where emotionally you're able to articulate what your client needs in a way so that somebody goes and being a prospect to a raving fan of that business?
So I'd say a good 80% of my process is the research. It's the background, it's doing the research into the ideal customer. So a lot of what I do is, and actually, you know, this isn't actually the writing bit. The writing bit comes fairly easily, I'd say, once you understand the market. So for example, if someone came to me and they wanted me to market their product to, say, dentists, which, you know, luckily in my case, when I work with dental companies, that bit's easy because a lot of the time I'm marketing to me.
What do I want?
Exactly. So it's understanding the psychology behind why people want what they want, you know, pain points. So what are the things that really kind of drive them to want to purchase something? And a lot of the time it's a negative emotion. It could be anger, it could be fear, whatever it could be. And then it goes from that to then figuring out exactly what it is that you want to write. And then that's what I mean. The writing process comes fairly simply after that. It's the research that is everything.
It's quite interesting. I read an article about some bloke talking about using AI for sales. And it's exactly what you were saying, Suggs. You were saying you can ask the AI for what is the problem. Then you can ask the AI for the solution to the problem. He said, but then you have to write it, because he said what the AI will write will not resonate with people. he said you can use it to a point where he said it will help you, but then he said there's a point you then have to take it away and say, right, I'm now going to put a person into it. I was thinking that's a clever way of using it.
But I think as humans, we've evolved rapidly this year in terms of our thinking. I think we started 2023 with people assuming that AI was going to, you know, wipe us out as a species. There were going to be no jobs. AI was going to do everything. And now we're only at the end of 2023 and people are already saying, it's going to be a tool that's going to help me. but it's not actually going to do the thing I want. It's going to give me structure, ideas, systems, processes, and point me in the right direction. But to make it really resonate and have an emotional element to
still
it,
needs a human.
That still needs the human to step
it's not
in
going
and,
to be
and
Skynet.
Just finish it off, exactly.
Which has no relevance, yeah. So you don't listen to Terminator.
No. I mean, I think we're all just predicting, aren't we, at this point? We don't really know. I mean, AI is the rate of evolution is so quick when it comes to AI compared to, because I kind of heard about it in 2020, I would say. People were using it then, and it wasn't great, but it was okay. Mm. And then now we've got to the point where we've got GPT-4, which is the latest kind of iteration of it, and that's able to transcribe things in images, and you're able to feed it images, and then it can dissect it and come up with different ideas from an image, let alone text.
Wow.
So it's already come a long way. So who knows?
Yeah. So when you create the word for a particular client in terms of, putting their proposition in front of the right people, does how those words appear, is that part of what you do as well? Or does that then become a marketing function? And I'm thinking things like how long the message is, what font style, what color, where it might appear on the page. Mm, because I'm just thinking that quite often we get so many messages come at us. What you don't want is your amazing words lost in the presentation.
Yeah. Well, luckily, it's fortunate that I had the graphic design background early on. That's helped me a lot, because both the words and design have to be congruent. They have to be able to... You can't... Just because I'm a writer, I can't let the words dictate everything. I can't just force the words to do all the work, because sometimes, for example, Facebook ads is a good example, because a lot of us see it on Facebook or Instagram, whatever you want to call it, meta ads now. It's driven a lot by the visual, and the writing has to be quite short, because people aren't generally going to read a long piece of text on something like Facebook. Otherwise, if they see a big block of text, they scroll past it. So for instance, I publish a lot on LinkedIn, and I publish, maybe 3-4 times a week doing different posts. And what I've learned is when I type in paragraphs, so when I type, let's say it's 5-6 line paragraphs, people tend not to want to read it. When I break it up into sentences and I put spacing in between it, it becomes a lot more digestible.
Wow.
Because that's just how we process information on a screen.
Mm. Out of interest, Suggs, have you noticed over the time that you've been doing it any change in interactions? So, if we become even less engaging on certain things. Yeah, because I remember once there was something, what was it? It took 11 seconds or something. That was our attention span. And then someone said it's now eight seconds. So do you then have to sort of adapt your style, because people are getting so many inputs, unless you are really smacking them in the face with a fish, then they're not paying attention?
To an extent, yes.
Wow.
But sometimes I get clients who believe that too strongly. So they always say, when I come back with copy, they say, make it more punchy, or make it shorter, make it more direct, And they quote that exact stat. They say, people have attention spans of 3 seconds, 5 seconds, 8, whatever the latest study is. Yeah. And my argument against that is, if you care enough about it, you'll probably read the whole thing. So there's a copywriter called Joe Sugarman. I don't know if you guys have come across him. One of the most famous copywriters, admin is what they used to call them. And he always talked about, if there was a 500-page book and it was written about your life, you'd read it end to end.
Yeah.
Because it concerns you. It's about you, and it's about your life and your tribulations and your trials. If it was about someone else, you're not going to read it, right? So in the same way with advertising, for example, or copywriting, if you're talking about someone's problem and it affects them that much,
they'll read it.
They will read, it doesn't matter how long, it could be 15,000 words, they will read the entire thing, because it hurts them that much and they want to know everything about it. But versus if you give that same piece of text to someone who doesn't have that problem, they couldn't care less.
It's really interesting though, isn't it? Because that's going back to that thing of, as you were saying, Suggs, that you need to have the human emotion to work out what is going to resonate with someone. But also it means that and I don't mean this rudely, but it might sound a bit weird. You're not just a copywriter, or people perceive a copywriter as a bloke who just knocks up some words. You're actually also saying to these companies, now, well, hang on a minute. Let me educate you in maybe how that sales process and funnel works. So it's fascinating. You've got to have the – otherwise the danger is you just end up producing stuff that other people use that you know is maybe not the best way of doing it.
But also,
so you've got to be quite resolute, haven't you? Saying, oi.
I think you could actually use it as a filter as well in that if someone's not prepared to read the, you know, 3, 4, 5 page or 10 paragraph message that's going out, they may have already discounted themselves through the filter as being your ideal candidate. Yeah. If someone's prepared to invest the time, I think about this podcast. The majority of people who tune into this podcast listen to it end to end because they've obviously listened before, I hope, and they've heard something they enjoyed and they know there's going to be good stuff through it. And so they'll commit their time. Because and that's the benefit of doing long form things like this. You know, we could just do 20-second snippets and whack them on TikTok. But yeah, I think people who genuinely want to learn and have more information coming their way are prepared to invest time. And I wonder whether from going back to the copywriting, whether those longer form messages actually can filter in the right sort of person who's already invested time before you then have the conversation or send an email or pick up the phone or whatever else it might be.
Amazing.
Yeah, definitely. I think a trend that's coming back in is email newsletters. So a lot of people are focusing on that more so than they were before. So that was a big thing in the kind of 2000s. Not that I knew much about it. I was like what, 8? But it, you know, it, around
you
were a graphic designer back then.
yeah, exactly. But around that time, newsletters were a big thing, and now it's coming back into the swing. And you're seeing a lot of companies now, and solopreneurs and small business owners, they're beginning to put out these big newsletters. And I sign up to a lot of them because obviously that's the trade. But I sign up to a lot of them. And I read the ones that truly take my interest. And a lot of them take about 15 minutes to read because it's like almost like a long blog post.
Yeah, it's interesting, isn't it? We used to do, I mean, it's interesting. We stopped it and then we're restarting it again. Those newsletters we used to do. And the open rate was like 40-odd% or something.
Huge.
It was like, whoa.
Yeah.
So do you write, obviously we've kind of focused on your almost kind of, you know, corporate creative writing side of things, where you have a client, you do the research, you understand their ideal avatar, you then create a message that would resonate with that audience. Do you do other writing as well? Do you still write songs? Do you do poetry? Do you use that kind of creative?
Can I add a question into that as well? What is the most fun thing you've had to do as your copywriting? And what is the worst thing you've had to do as a copywriter? I'm assuming you could probably not discount that one. Anyway, go back to Andy's question and throw that one in as well.
Yeah. I think in terms of the more creative side of things, I don't make music as much as I'd want to. And the reason for that is I think once you start working, your inspiration starts to go down the drain. It was different when I was in school or I was in uni. Yeah, fine, you're studying a lot, but you're going to parties, you're out with friends, you're seeing things, you're doing things, and you can talk about it in your music. Whereas once you start working and you enter the proverbial rat race, you're kind of just, you're in the same routine. So you're less inspired to talk about things. And right now, for example, just the other week, I was trying to sit down and just write a song, not to put it out, just for my own interest. And I just couldn't think of anything. I was just sitting there for a good half an hour and I just couldn't think of anything. Everything sounded cheesy. It sounded a bit, it wasn't genuine. So I just thought,
Is there merit in rejigging your life in a style to create more experiences that would then feed back into the creativity? Is that because you're perhaps spending too much time on the dentistry?
It's possible. It's possible, yeah. But I think also it's the people you're around. You know, in uni, for example, the whole time I was making music, I was around friends who were making music as well every single day. You know, you're in uni, you go to lectures with them and we talk about music together and it's always in your head.
Yeah.
And I'm watching music videos and interviews, and I was so engorged and engrossed within that kind of scene. Whereas you're absolutely right. Once you start working, you just, all you see are, you know, you just see patients and you see Yeah, pretty, all you're thinking about is UDAs.
Pretty
and
hard to do a hip hop song about endo UDAs and periods. Yeah. Exactly. Maybe there's an opportunity.
Might not be a best, might not be a bestseller.
Exactly. I think it's just you don't have as much inspiration. But I still have my fun doing copywriting. Mm. So you know that's. I think in terms of the fun stuff that I get to do, it tends to be the stuff that the clients give me the most free rein on. they kind of just say, look, we trust you. Go do what you got to do. And for example, so the stuff I do now is kind of building out funnels. So I'll write a whole landing page, things like that. And I like businesses that are not too serious. So they're kind of, they've got a bit of a tongue-in-cheek brand. You know, you can write a bit more fun, jokey kind of humorous content versus something that's very straight-laced and you have to follow. So, for example, in healthcare, the difficult things that I have to encounter are compliance.
Yeah, regulation.
Especially, obviously, in dentistry and you have to, you can't make claims that are crazy because you'll either get, not only get taken down off the platform, but, you know, you'll be, regulators will come down hard on you.
Mm.
And what's the most fun one do you think you've done?
I'd say it's difficult to pick one. Fun's a kind of, I don't know if that's the right adjective for it.
Maybe out there. How about that? Maybe if we gather one that you felt was like, yeah, this was a really good bit of work that I felt was on the edge.
So there was a supplement brand that I worked with, and they, although the ethics of the brand I don't really know too much about, it was actually the time when I first started out on Upwork, and it was a supplement brand, and it was about prostate health or something like that. Now, I don't know how effective that stuff was, and I didn't know much about it, but a lot of the jokes you could run, I'm not going to repeat them, but, you know, there's a lot to do with men's prostate health and men's, you know,
performance.
Yeah, performance. exactly. That's a great way to put it.
I think Chris saved you there.
Exactly. I was thinking, quick, performance.
I found that stuff quite funny because they were quite relaxed as well. So they kind of allowed me to flex my creativity with it. And that was quite fun to do.
Mm. Brilliant.
Is, accepting the compliance point, is dentistry quite an open profession to creative messages, or is it quite
dull,
rigid and dull?
I know you're trying to avoid that. Andy. I thought you were trying to be very good.
But no, but because of the compliance, is it hard sometimes to show the true creativity that you want for fear of kind of getting a bit too close to the GDC and somebody having a look at it and be uncomfortable?
Yeah, for sure. I always find that, and I find that's why I don't. So for example, I don't work a lot with dental practices.
Right.
That's for another reason. I don't think they need as much copy. I think a lot of it is they have different demands for what they need. But I think with dentistry, you can only be so creative before you're offending someone. Mm. And people, you know, especially in dentistry, and we see it in dental Facebook groups all the time, you know, people have strong opinions on what's considered professional and what's considered unprofessional.
Yeah, that's true, isn't it?
And you just have to tread very carefully to make sure that, and you know, people will inevitably with marketing, some people are going to like it, some people are going to hate it. Yeah, that's fine. Yeah. But when you're maliciously, and I've seen this, maliciously trying to shut someone down for what they're putting out there,
that's,
I think,
good.
You know, unless you're harming people, I don't see the point in, I don't see why you take the time out of your day to do that.
Yeah. But equally, I think where you take kind of the obtuse position, people can quite like that. They quite like, so somebody like James Watt from BrewDog, I know there's a bit of a history there in terms of his kind of leadership in that business, but BrewDog messages really stand out. And the way he still tells stories, you kind of want to read them because they're interesting. And I guess in an industry like that, it's easier. And that doesn't translate well in the dentistry with so much structure. So there's quite a lot of pressure on you, you know, not necessarily just in dentistry, but in healthcare, trying to come up with content that resonates with the audience for the product services that are being sold, but also ticks the compliance box as well. That's quite a fine
it's
line.
It's a hard
to
balance,
walk,
isn't it?
To
gather, walk, I'd imagine.
And I actually think So the companies that I work with that are clinician-led, they tend to be the ones that want to be more straight-laced. And I don't know if that's just because naturally clinicians are very logical and they want everything to be, you know, follow a structure. So for example, I was once working with a brand that was led by a doctor, an orthopedic doctor, and I was, you know, I wrote the copy and it was, everything was fine. And he said, no, it's too salesy. You know, he said, doctors will see right through that. We need to include more numbers. We need to include more studies and we need to this and that. And I just said, end of the day, it doesn't matter if you're marketing to PhD students or, you know, quantum physics graduates. Mm. It doesn't matter how smart someone is. They're always going to, emotion's always going to, you know, mm-hmm. trump logic. Yeah. So I think sometimes we can be guilty, especially a lot of us who are clinicians, be guilty of kind of weighing in too much on the logic side of things. Like logic, you know, I think you lead with the emotion and then you justify it with the logic mm-hmm. rather than the other way around.
Have you ever had clients where you just said, actually, I don't think I can work with you?
Yeah. Luckily, well, this is the thing. Because of dentistry, it allows me that flexibility to say no, mm-hmm. whereas I think if copywriting was my full-time income, I'd have to just say yes to everything, which would make it far more difficult. But I think because I have the luxury of just saying no, I often say no to anyone who micromanages. Mm. So if I've ever been, when I get micromanaged or I've got, you know, people constantly checking in, or on my Google Docs, I've got people leaving comments constantly, it gets a bit draining. And I just say, look, I think it's better to call it quits at this point because I don't want to disappoint them.
Yeah.
But in the same sense, I don't want to be annoyed. Yeah. You know, I've had a hard day at work.
You can't be be for everybody, can you?
No.
And I think that's a great lesson that people need to learn, is that some people you are and some people you can't.
And also, I think if you're bringing in a creative person, you want them for their creativity. Yeah. So they're micromanaging them and commenting on every little, you know, apostrophe or comma or semicolon or whatever else it might be. It makes no sense. It's like,
you know, why bar dog and bark yourself?
Yeah.
Right? Yeah. Yeah, no, it doesn't make sense to me, because sometimes I feel they could do a better job.
Yeah.
So in which case,
why bother engaging?
Crack on and do it yourself.
Exactly. Yeah. Exactly.
If we rolled out, I don't know, 5-7 years from now, what do you think your future looks like? Do you think there'll be less of a reliance on dentistry, more copywriting, or do you think you'll still have that kind of balance in there?
You have a bandana on your head.
back to the songwriting.
Yeah.
Back to it, yeah. No, well, that's the aim. I mean, I think ultimately I don't want to be solely focused on dentistry in 5 to 7 years. That doesn't mean I want to leave the profession.
No.
I still enjoy my job. And I still want it to be there in some capacity, but I definitely want to reduce how much I do it. Whether it will be copywriting per se that I'm doing, or it might be something else, or I might branch out in terms of what I'm doing in the funnel. So I might do more marketing of things.
Yeah.
But I think that's where I want my career to go at this stage.
Mm. It's great to have the graphic design in your skill set, isn't it, to go with the copywriting? Because then you're not just creating words, you're creating what something looks like that drags an attention. I think that's a great combo.
Yeah. It's and that's the other thing. I think if I was to branch out, I think because I've got those two skill sets already and I'm able to develop websites within reason, I can kind of do the whole thing anyway. It's just a case of getting the practice in and getting the reps in, just like anything else.
So you're saying in dentistry, it's kind of hard in terms of some of the sort of copywriting and the need for it. Do you think within the profession, people attach the significance to the written word to the extent that they should? Because I'm more thinking about things like social media platforms. Dentistry is a very visual thing. You know, if you scroll down a dentist page, you'll see, you know, smiley faces and teeth, or in the worst case, retractors and teeth.
Sensitive content, isn't it?
But isn't it? You see lots of, and because it's a very visual world, particularly on the aesthetic side of things, is there less of a reliance and not the significance attached to words that perhaps there might be? Are people missing out on a certain proportion of their audience and target patients by not using words?
I think in the context that you described with Instagram, because it's such a visual platform, written word probably isn't as important. I actually think in terms of what the skills that copywriting teaches, can be applied more to patient management. So a lot of the skills, in terms of all the skills that I've learned throughout, you know, since the graphic design days to now, copywriting has been the one that's the most transferable, because I don't just use it as a writer. The skills that I've learned are persuasion and communication. And a lot of the principles within copywriting can be applied to the way that I talk to patients. And
interesting,
you know, yeah. And things like, I mean, I know this is a dirty word in dentistry, but it's selling, you know, it helps me to,
we'll have to bleep that out.
We'll edit that out.
That's fine.
but it does help because a lot of the same principles apply, whether it be, you know, in dentistry or in copywriting. And I think that's where people could probably, you don't have to necessarily be into copywriting, but just reading a little bit about it can probably open your eyes up to how you can communicate better with patients. And I think that's where the value would come in more for dentists and clinicians.
Interesting. It is interesting.
Yeah. Suggs, it's been fascinating. And I think you talk about it so passionately. And I think there's a funny link that kind of the pioneer and the godfather's called Sugarman, and we call you Suggs, which is kind of a modern version of Sugarman. So I quite like that there's a link that we've got there. We always ask our guests two questions at the end.
And No madness joke.
So the first one we have for you is, if you could be the fly on a wall in a situation, when would that be and who would be there?
I was just looking at PayPal, realised he was 12. Sorry, Sykes, it just made me laugh.
No. What I was thinking of was, I don't know if you guys follow football much, but when I would love to have been in the dressing room when Jurgen Klopp, when Liverpool 3-0 down to Barcelona. Oh. I'd love to know what you said. Like, how do you... It's one thing being able to motivate one person, but to be able to motivate a whole squad when the whole world's basically saying you're written off, you're against one of the best teams in the world. Yeah, you're playing at home. But I'd love to know, what is it that you said? And it's not the first time Liverpool's done it. Like, they've done it so many times when they've done these crazy
corners. That was Trent Alexander's. Yeah. That was the corner thing, wasn't it?
That was the...
such a brilliant moment.
Yeah. Like, I just want to know what is it you say? Like, how do you motivate?
It's almost like the ultimate lesson in leadership, isn't it? You've got 15 minutes. You're in a situation that could not be worse. And you have to harness that group to change completely in 45 minutes.
And somehow you don't think it's shouting.
No.
You know, like Ferguson was, what was it, the hairdryer? But you somehow feel it wouldn't have been a hairdryer. It would have been, well, like, you know, I don't know. It'd be fascinating.
Like you say, there's so many options. Yeah. You know, do you shout? Do you go quiet? Do you say, well, you've let yourselves down? You know, it's over. You can't pull this back. You know, you use reverse psychology.
Do you use disappointed?
Yeah.
My children hate disappointed.
It'd be fascinating to see what tactic there is. And also, you've not got long because the clock's ticking. You can't go back to the training ground and dissect it and think you've got, you know, by the time they kind of get off the pitch in the changing room and get back out again, you've probably got something like 12 or 13 minutes to turn it around. But whatever he said worked.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly.
What's those Amazon Prime Video things? What they call them, All or Nothing or something? I don't think. Yeah.
That's what I wish.
But apparently he's
just not willing to do it.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, he's not willing to allow cameras into his dressing room, which is fair enough.
Yeah. Well, I suppose if you've got, you know, for somebody like him, there's a degree of magic sauce, isn't there, in terms of how he goes about it. And I know you can't kind of just watch a documentary on somebody and mimic them, but there will be elements of what he does that does make him and his team special. So as a follow-on from that, if you could meet somebody, you could sit down with them and have half an hour chat, who would you like to have a conversation with, given the opportunity?
And we all say living or dead, fact or fiction?
This one's a bit of a strange one because I think this is more recent, but someone I've got into a lot recently is Derren Brown. And I've so another one of my past, well, pursuits, I would say, was magic. Oh. So I always liked doing magic. That never went anywhere. I just did it in my bedroom. Yeah. But it was always something that fascinated me. And I always saw Derren Brown as, you know, he's just a magician. He did the hypnosis stuff whatever. But the reason why it's come back around was because I started reading his books, and the guy's an amazing writer, for one. He understands psychology really well. So I'd love to know, in his heyday, when he was doing all that mentalism stuff and he was doing the Russian roulette stuff, you know, what was it like, and how did he actually I want to know the secrets, you know, I want to know how he actually does it. And he just seems like a really funny guy.
Yeah.
To be honest.
There was something about that recently, wasn't there, Suggs? Was it? I can't remember. They said that when he did the Russian roulette, there was a 15-second delay between what was on and what was broadcast, just in case it did go wrong.
Oh, really?
Yeah, yeah. It was something article I was reading or something about, and they said, yeah, because they showed that Russian roulette thing and then it was a real bullet and something. Mm. And they said, yeah, when they broadcast it, there was a 15-second delay between what you actually saw and what actually happened, just in case it didn't quite work, because they didn't want to show someone blowing their brains out on TV, which I thought was interesting.
I don't know quite how he does it, but he seems to create an intensity to his acts that other people just don't bring. You know, you're really hanging on every moment.
You're so
of
so engaged,
happening.
Aren't you?
And you know, he's an amazing storyteller through the art that he's got, and you really do get sucked into the whole experience of it.
Mm. Yeah, and I think that's it. That's what gravitates me towards him is the storytelling more so than the actual magic.
Yes,
you know, the magic anyone can technically do if you learn the skill and you know you learn the techniques, but it's the performance, you know, it's the storytelling, how he gets you to feel one emotion and then feel another emotion, that kind of thing. That's what really hits.
That's brilliant.
Suggs, it's been wonderful.
Yeah, thank
you very
you
much
very
indeed.
Much.
Fascinating. I think the mixture of what you do is great. I'm sure a lot of people are going to go away and think more about words having listened to this. And I think in a world where we move very quickly, it has become very visual, you know, either with video or audio. I think taking 10 seconds just to step back and remind ourselves and remember how important and how powerful words can be is really important. If you could let us have your link and we can drop that in the guest notes if people want to reach out to you and you know, kind of have a chat, that would be great. But it's been a fascinating conversation. It's been really, really enjoyable.
Yeah, brilliant. Thank you for your time. And as you say, Andy, not a huge, you know, designer, hip hop, and a dentist as well. Like, just sort of roll that in that takes 4 days a week. Yeah. It's brilliant.
So
really
much
good.
Going
Thank
on.
You.
So much going on. Right, look, obviously, so it's good to speak to you.
Thanks, man.
Thank
Cheers,
you.
Dada.
Thanks.
Thank you for listening to this episode of Dentology, where we discuss the business of dentistry. If you like what you heard, please do subscribe where you found this episode. That would be amazing. And also follow us on Instagram.